Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode of Excess Returns, Jack and I sit down with our good friend Tobias Carlyle to talk value investing, Warren Buffett, the future of Berkshire Hathaway, Toby's views on AI and inflation, and much more. Toby's a deep, thoughtful, and measured thinker that brings humility, rationality, and a historical perspective to each and every conversation we have with him. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Acquire Funds' Toby Carlyle, the man who single-handedly got us into podcasting. Toby, thank you for coming back on with us, sir.
It's good to see you guys again.
The man who I like to credit single-handedly got Jack and I in the podcasting business.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, look at the empire we've built since then, Toby. It's, very impressive.
We always like to have you on, Toby. We appreciate it. Check in on what's going on in the value stock universe, sort of what you're seeing in the markets, what you're sensing with sort of the value growth stock spread, and just have a conversation around a bunch of different topical stuff that I think investors can always learn from. Where we thought we'd start, and I don't know if you saw the whole entire interview or quote, but I know you guys were you and Jake were talking about it with one of your recent guests on Value After Hours, John. I forgot his last name. Starts with an R. Value
Rotondi,
investor guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was a great discussion, by the way. But this this interview that David Einhorn did with Barry Ritholtz, in which he was basically saying that, you know, the markets are broken and paying less attention to fundamentals. And sort of the passive investing has kind of like broken the markets from a fundamental investing standpoint. And so he's focused on strategies that are effectively returning cash to shareholders in some way, not waiting for mean reversion or multiple expansion, because that wasn't happening with a lot of his names. And then, you know, sort of looking for these companies that are returning cash. So just in general, I mean, what do you think about the idea that market sort of cares less about fundamentals these days?
So Michael Green has this thesis that passive flows have reached a tipping point or overwhelmed the active investment in the market, such that the more space that a company occupies in a big index like the SPY or whatever, the more flows it gets, and therefore the companies that aren't in the index or have only a little market capitalization. So everything's going to grow sort of according to its size, which is sort of anti-value in a sense. That value tends to be, you know, if you have two companies with the same $100 million in earnings and one's on a 5x PE, it's got a $500 million market cap, and the other one's on 20x PE, it's got a $2 billion market cap. It's getting 4x the flows of the, even though the earnings are the same, like, everything else is the same. It's just the market cap. So they see more flows, so their stock price goes up more. The thesis sort of turns on this, the fact that it's like, it's not reversible. All of the passive money's coming in from retirement money. At some point, the retirement money comes out, and that causes a, beforehand, there's a crack up boom, and then there's a complete collapse. I don't know about all of that stuff. It's sort of a little bit beyond my pay grade. I find it hard to believe, honestly, but I don't really worry about it too much. The objective as a value investor, I don't really care so much about the stock price performance, even after I buy something, because the returns for me when I buy are already baked in at the price that I pay, whether it's quoted in the market or not. So the returns that I get, really there are two sources. There's the dividend yield and or the shareholder yield, which is the buybacks and capital returns and dividends and all that sort of stuff. And then there's the portion of earnings that are reinvested in the business, reinvested at the marginal return on invested capital. And you can find over time that will give you an output. You can sum that to the yield. That's your expected return. Whatever happens to the stock price in the interim between when you hold it and when you sell it is kind of irrelevant. Like that's the compounding is going on. And you can be opportunistic, can just sit in there and wait. The idea that you would focus more on the Einhorn's idea is that, well, we're not getting rewarded for the compounding portion. We're not getting rewarded for the reinvestment at the marginal rate. All we're getting rewarded for, well, we're not seeing any multiple expansion. So therefore, let's focus more on the yield portion. Let's make sure we're getting enough yield out. And that's how we're going to get our return, which that's what Buffett has been doing for a very long period of time. You know, all of Buffett's acquisitions, like you can look at BNSF as an example of, like, it's not a publicly listed company. It's private. He's bought it, owns it privately. I don't know the exact figures. I've sort of forgotten all of these because it was so long ago now, but he got most of his capital back pretty quickly when he bought BNSF. It's true also with the purchase of Oxy. You know, he bought Oxy, it's returning capital. The great concern with all of these oil and gas companies is that they tend to do most of their reinvestment at peak cycle, like all of the mergers and all of the action goes on peak cycle. And he doesn't want that to happen. He wants them, it's a good business. It's not a lot of money reinvested in the business. It throws off a lot of cash. Just return that to the shareholders. We'll do very well. And he's so focused on it that he took a slide from one of their presentations and he put it in his own shareholder meeting presentation. And he named the CEO, is it Vicky Golub, I think her name is. And he said, here's what you guys have said publicly. You're going to return capital. I want you to keep on returning capital because you've said that you're going to do that. And so he's sort of just kind of, you know, iron fist in the velvet glove, encouragement and the way that he does it. Like there's no threat. He's just saying, you've made this public statement. I'm investing on the basis, on a good faith basis of this public statement. I expect you to sort of adhere to this public statement that you're going to return capital. I think that it's certainly a good approach. There's nothing wrong with investing that way, but it is only one source of the returns. There is this other source of returns. And it doesn't matter if you don't get the multiple re-rating. If you're getting that incremental reinvestment, you can do a calculation. And that calculation that I outlined before, where you're looking at marginal return on invested capital multiplied by the amount of money that's reinvested, plus the yield, all of the yield that comes out, share buyback, dividend yield, capital return, whatever, all of that stuff. That is your return, whatever happens to the multiple, you get that return. The multiple has to compress, you know, commensurate with your compounding for you to not get that return. So when I think about this stuff, I don't actually care what the market does. I always invest on the basis that the multiple's not going to re-rate. I assume there's going to be no multiple re-rating over the period of time that I hold it. And for some companies where they are doing a lot of buybacks, I would prefer it if they don't re-rate up because I'm going to make a lot more money ultimately. If they stay cheap and buy back stock, the Motley Fool used to run this famous ad where they had, here's IBM, which was always really, really expensive at this massive multiple. And this is back when IBM was like the best returning stock for a very long period of time. It was like IBM and Microsoft and Intel and all those kind of companies through the PC boom a long time ago. And they would say, IBM has sort of rocketed earnings, stayed at this very high multiple. And you would have got this return over like a 10 or 20 year holding period. And then they would compare it to Tootsie Roll, you know, which makes Tootsie Rolls. And all that Tootsie Roll was controlled by a family, not a tech company, makes a candy that people like to eat. Not very many people, but enough people. And they would take that cash. And because nobody wanted to own the stock either, because that's a really boring company, it was always trading at a really low multiple. They'd buy back stock all the time. And the Motley Fool's ad would say, look at the performance of Tootsie Roll over this long period of time. It massively outperformed IBM. So do I care if the market recognizes the value that I see in these things after I buy them? No, I don't. Because I'm already buying these things on the basis that I'm going to get this source of return from the reinvestment and the yield. I would prefer it if it doesn't get re-rated. If they're buying back stock, that's the best case outcome. That means that management is aware of the undervaluation. They have the free cash flow there to buy back stock, or they have the cash there to buy back stock. And they're thinking about shareholders rather than expanding their own domain, which are all three very strong signals for buying something. So when they buy back a whole lot of stock, with any luck, somewhere down the line, I'll be the last man standing. They buy back all of the stock. I'll still have my position. We'll take that company private. Now that it's not quoted in the stock market anymore, I'm not getting the multiple expansion anymore, but am I not making any money? Of course I'm still making money. I'm getting the reinvestment and I'm getting the dividend yield. I'm still getting the return. So I think it's a silly argument from both sides. I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the way that returns generated in the stock market. And I think that it's largely a result of people who think like stock market operators rather than business owners. And so I think like a business owner, I think like a stock market operator.
So
I love it.
If I think about it at a high level, so the idea is if I want to get a return, I can get it in a few different ways. One is I can get paid dividends or they can buy back the stock. I can get it directly from the company. Two is the company's earnings can go up and I can maintain the same multiple. So I'm getting a return even if there's no multiple expansion. And then three is the multiple expansion. And the idea is those first two are going to happen irrespective of if the market cares about the multiple expansion. Anyways, that is that kind of the idea?
I don't think you can, they would say that the criticism of the deep value guys, and I'm a deep value guy, the criticism of the deep value guys used to be, well, all you're relying on is this mean reversion in the multiple. Like you're buying at a cheap multiple, expecting the multiple to go up. It's a shitty business. It's not going to grow. So therefore, you're focused on price return and not business return. And I think that that's a fair criticism. But I think that you just don't rely on the multiple return. Like you can do a calculation where you're not relying on multiple expansion and you can still see what sort of return you're going to get. If you're getting a satisfactory return, what do you care whether there's multiple expansion?
Yeah, and I think that was kind of, to some degree, Einhorn is agreeing with you because he's trying to find companies where he is getting that return, even if nobody's paying attention. Because one of his points was in that small cap space right now, he doesn't think near, and I don't know if you agree with this, you can let me know, like there's a lot less investors paying attention in that small cap space than there used to be. And so those people that would bid up the stock after good earnings, like there aren't as many of them there. So you don't see it. Like he was saying, I get good results from my companies and no one seems to care.
I don't know if there are more or less. It would make sense that there are less because all of the action has been in big, growthy tech mostly. And so all of the young folks who I talk to, when they hear that I'm a value investor, they're just like, that's crazy. Like, why would you kind of consign yourself to the dustbin of history? Like, why would you go out and purposefully not make any money in this market? And the reason is because I've been through a few cycles and I've seen what happens on the downside of a cycle. And I'm not trying to win every single year or every single rolling 3 or 5 or 10 year period. I'm trying to survive every single year, rolling 3, 5 and 10 year period. My goal is to be here at the end of the race. To win the race, you must first finish the race. And so that's my goal. I'm going to get all the way to the end with all of my chips still on the table. So I'm focused on downside risk first. I'm focused on cash flows, sensible managements, robust business models that don't do really well for 6 or 7 years and then completely shit the bed in year seven where, like some credit card type companies where they don't know how many write-offs they're going to get through the recession. When the recession hits, like they're done. Some banks are like that. There are lots of business models all like that. I think that it's possible that it is that there are fewer people investing in the sector, but isn't that why we do this stuff? Isn't that what we're looking for? We want there to be less competition. I would love it if everybody packed up and went and looked at large growthy tech. I don't want the multiple expansion. I'm going to be doing this for a long time. I'll keep on buying this stuff until I'm the last guy owning all of it. I don't mind doing that at all. And I don't know why other value guys don't want to do that too.
Yeah, sort of a hard left turn here, but it's a good commercial when Toby can bring up Tootsie Roll. And I still remember how many licks does it take to get to the center of that Tootsie Roll pop. Sort of stays with you.
How many is it?
Commercial. I'm still looking for it.
If they were leaving it up to you to figure it out, right? Was that the commercial?
Yeah. But let's just go back to Buffett for a second. What's interesting with Buffett? He loves dividends. He loves companies that are buying back stock. Actually, in his shareholder letter this year, I thought it was interesting. He was talking about how because Berkshire Hathaway owners own indirectly through Berkshire part of Apple, part of Coke, part of American Express, that the buybacks that those companies do actually results in them indirectly owning more of the, like the holding that Buffett owns in the portfolio, but also more of Berkshire Hathaway stock. So it's this like derivative amplifying almost effect of these buybacks. And he talks a lot about too, like how much dividends, to your point about Burlington Northern, and I mean, Apple's paying a dividend now, and you know, most of the stuff I think that he holds is probably paying a dividend, just how much profits are being generated at Berkshire, because it's just such a massive company with such massive positions. Anyways, just sort of an observation.
I think he would say that, I think he says this in his letters, that the ideal business, like the theoretical ideal business, is a business that has this unlimited runway for reinvestment and takes all of its free cash flow and reinvests it at a above market return, or a very, very high rate of return. And so he would say See's Candy is an example of that. Like basically the top line growth in See's Candy is absolutely minimal. It might be 2% a year. The global growth in chocolate is like 2% a year. And See's Candy in particular has this problem that nobody would buy a box of See's Candy for themselves. Everybody buys it as a gift, and everybody loves to get it as a gift, and everybody loves to eat them. But no one would go into a store and buy one for themselves. So they have this, like, there's a psychological problem with it. But having said that, you know, California and now lots of places in the States, people will go in and they will buy a box of See's Candy, and it's poisonously expensive. It's crazy expensive when you go to buy it. The margins on there are astronomical, but they still sell it all out every single year. So the prices aren't high enough. They've really not grown the top line very much in that business, but it's thrown off massive amounts of capital. It's basically built Berkshire Hathaway, you know, for an investment of whatever it is. It was 27 up front, and then they've thrown another 30 at it over whatever the 50 years that they've held it, something like that, whatever it is. And it's thrown off, you know, billions of dollars that they've then, like an ordinary investor could have reinvested those cash flows and been fabulously wealthy at the end. But you take those cash flows and you give it to Buffett, then it just, he's gone and bought other See's Candies that do the same thing. And it's just had this compounding multiplicative effect. So I think that that's the ideal business, one that doesn't require any reinvestment and probably doesn't pay a dip. See's can't reinvest, but you know, the idea is that it just takes the capital that you give it and just reinvests it forever. Not very many businesses can do that. And it's often the businesses that you don't want to reinvest in that require the money, like they're the ones that soak up all the capital all the time. But I think that when you can't find the ones that can absorb infinite capital on a lot, very long runway, then you want one that still maintains the very high returns on capital, but returns most of it to you. So you can then go and find your own other high return on invested capital businesses.
Just while we're on the topic of Berkshire, what do you think happens to Berkshire beyond Buffett? Like I've been thinking about that a lot now that Munger's gone, like on just a lot of different levels, like on the levels of their investment strategy, on the levels of, like, if I think back to 2008, you know, when he was able to come in with his reputation and do what he did with Goldman Sachs, and you know, not only get a good return, but like instill confidence back in the world. Like, what do you think happens to that when he's not around?
It won't be as good. The thing is, the thing that makes Berkshire unique is that it has this incredible culture, and culture is instilled from the top down. I've worked in other businesses where there were two entrepreneurs in it, and the culture started at the very top with them, and it was sort of like an elite business environment, elite business culture, because they were there. But it's just so easy to take the easier route rather than like stick to the hard stuff, that it's inevitable. There's nobody else who can maintain culture like Buffett does. It won't be fast, but of course it will deteriorate over time. At some point it'll get too cheap. I'm sure it'll be busted up. It'll probably happen in my lifetime, but or it may not. It may take a lot longer than that. I don't know. But I think that ultimately it relies on Buffett and Munger sort of carrying the torch at the top, and without them there, it must deteriorate.
You think like the annual meeting and stuff will still, I mean, it probably won't be what it once was, but will it still be an event?
You know, I'd say there'll be a huge drop off the first year he's not there, and then it'll shrink every year after that.
I would imagine a lot of his shareholder base is kind of older too.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, there's like that transition.
And you give it to the kids, well. The kids don't have the same sort of emotional attachment to it.
Did you see, just as we'll move on from this in a second, but there was that gift given to, it was a medical school in New York City, and it was the largest philanthropic gift, I think, to any academic, but the money came from a woman donated it. But it was from, an investment in Berkshire Hathaway way back. And this guy was like, the husband that passed away was one of Buffett's good friends. And anyways, it's paying now full tuition for all medical school students for the rest of the school's future.
I mean, it's amazing. Yeah.
Which is pretty
cool. That's
great. Yeah.
It's crazy, by the way. Just, I know some people who are like this, like people who were in Omaha at that time. Like, it's amazing how much wealth was created. Like people who were investing with him early and who were in Omaha, like families that came from there, like they've generated amazing amounts of wealth off of what he's done.
Extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, even the annual meeting every year that the hotel prices go up, I'm sure that the hotels make a loss for 360 days of the year. And then 5 days of the year, they make their entire year's profit.
Kind of reminds me of Microsoft too, of like how much wealth was created. Did you guys, just another quick side note here. This is nuts. I read this morning in the Wall Street Journal article, like open AI positions, like $1 million comp. It's like the base plus like the accelerated stock options and all that stuff. It's like these top AI developers are getting like $900 to $1 million a year in terms of compensation, which is crazy.
That's big money. That's real money. Does it rely on OpenAI having $100 billion market cap?
I don't know. It might be tied to that. I didn't get to that specific. But then I was thinking they are in California, so basically 50% of it. You know,
well, not if you get it in the options, and you can turn that into long term capital gains.
Yeah.
What do you think about? I've been thinking a lot about inflation in terms of value. Like, do you think? I mean, obviously, I don't know where inflation is going to go. You know, I'm the last person that should be predicting that. But do you think there's any changes? I mean, have you thought anything about anything with your investment strategy? Like, if we do get a prolonged period of inflation, is there anything you do differently? I mean, value tends, you know, at least in theory, people think value is a good place to be in an inflationary environment. But do you think about anything with your strategy in terms of inflation?
I hate to just regurgitate Buffett all the time, but he is the guy who, you know, I've got my de facto MBA by reading Berkshire Hathaway letters. So this is sort of shapes the way I think about everything. And I read his explanations and I think that's probably right. I mean, it's not like I'm just regurgitating it because he said it. I think through it too. But he says that, you know, the 70s, they had a similar problem where inflation was running hot. And he says, like, even though Berkshire had this stunning performance through the 70s, someone pointed out that gold did as well as a share of Berkshire. And gold didn't do anything. And there's a lot of work and effort and blood and sweat and tears in Berkshire. And he said the mistake that everybody makes is that they think that you need to be in things that have, you know, lots of hard assets, because the hard assets go up in value. But he said what that misses is that if you have to replace those, you've got to maintain those hard assets. You've got to replace those hard assets. You know, you spend $1 million in year zero and then you earn 100, 200, whatever, over the 10 years that you hold them. And then you get to the end and you need, instead of spending $1 million, now you got to spend $2 million to replace those assets. So all of those 10 years of profits are sort of eaten up by the reinvestment in the hard assets at the end of it. And so are hard assets the answer to that? I don't know. Maybe if you never have to, maybe if it's a mine, you never have to reinvest in the mine. Maybe that sort of works well. But I think that the higher return on invested capital businesses possibly do better. And maybe that's why all of the techie companies have done, it's the fear of inflation that's pushed up the valuations of all of those things. I really don't know. I think you want to be in, you know, it's going to be bad for anybody who doesn't hold a lot of investment assets. So it's going to hit the poor and middle class much harder than it hits the wealthy. The wealthy aren't going to notice at all. The poor and middle class are going to get smashed pretty hard. I don't think it's good for anybody. I think that after inflation returns are going to be, real returns are going to be low for the whole period that we've run this, you know, the era of financial repression, which I think is what James Montier called And he wrote this article in 2010 or something like that. And he said the era of financial repression, when they start, these things take decades, 2 or 3 decades. And I remember reading that in 2010 or 2005 or something like that and thinking, gee, that's a long time. And now here we are in 2024. And really, it's kicking off. We're starting to see the impact of the inflation, even though I think the seeds of it were sown through from 2010 onwards, really, with Bernanke pinning interest rates at zero and flooding the market with money, which has seen, you know, stocks go to the moon, crypto go to the moon, real estate's gone to the moon. Maybe other things will catch up now. I don't think there's really any good way to. I don't think there's any really real way to prosper from the inflation. I think that all you can do is kind of just try to keep up after tax, after inflation. And the way to do that will be owning assets. Which ones? I don't know. That's a tough question to answer.
Yeah, it's been challenging because, you know, people have, stocks and bonds have worked so well for so long. And then you get into a situation where they don't for a little bit. And then, but then the challenge is predicting the future. Like we don't know. I mean, you may have an opinion. I don't have an opinion that's, anybody should listen to on where inflation is going to go in the future. So
where it's going to go, I don't know. But yeah, what you do when it's here, I don't know that either.
Yeah, yeah, because to some degree that requires predicting what it's going to do in the future. I mean, obviously the investment strategy is going to work if it's going to go back to 2% is different than the one that's going to work if it's going to go to 7% probably. You know, we have had a lot of guys on the podcast, and I have come around to this a lot. Like a lot of guys like Corey Hofstein and a lot of guys that always run these types of strategies that, you know, work in all four quadrants. Yeah. You know, they never owned just stocks and bonds. They always owned other stuff, you know, to try to have like more of a total return strategy that does well regardless of the economic environment, recognizing that inflation is something that has happened a good amount of the time historically, even if we haven't seen it recently. So I've kind of come around to that idea. But yeah, I mean, I think the problem people get into is when they want to say, all right, I'm going to go to that strategy because there is inflation. And by that time, inflation is dissipating. You know, when you're bouncing back and forth, it's probably when you get in trouble.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think trying to predict what's going to happen is kind of a little bit of a fool's game. You want to be playing whatever's going to happen is to be prepared for whatever happens rather than to predict what is going to happen. Because the problem with predicting is that, you know, I would not have predicted any of the things that have happened over the last few years. If, you know, interest rates have gone from 0 to 5, 6%, pushing up in the short end of the yield curve there. And if you told me that stocks would rally like this while the interest rates went up like that, I'd have said there's just no chance. And here we are. Stocks are up a lot. Show no, like the stock SPY this year, it's a 45 degree line with hardly any pullbacks. And interest rates have just gone up. Everybody thinks that interest rates are going to get cut. And the Fed seems to be like encouraging that idea. We're going to cut at some point in the future. But the start of the year, like last year, everybody said there's going to be a cut before the end of the year. This year, they say there's going to be 6 cuts. Here we are in March. There have been no cuts. Now it's 3 cuts. I can easily see that we just keep on going forward like this. And when you look at the mandate of the Fed, it's stable money supply and full employment. Employment is at all-time lows. Sorry, you know, unemployment's at all-time lows. Stock market's at all-time highs. Property market is more expensive relative to median incomes than it's been at almost any other point in time in history. Hard to imagine that is the kind of market that you want to cut into. But I don't know. Like these are human beings making decisions, not really based on data. I think they've got other sort of considerations. So impossible to predict what the Fed will do, and then to work out what you're going to do based on what the Fed's going to do, like fool's game.
Yeah. Well, I think it is interesting. You know, usually the Fed is cutting once we're sort of already in a recession. And here we're talking about, like, to your point, things are looking pretty decent. And the expectation of cutting, it's almost like maybe we would be better off for them not to cut and to hold that ammunition for when they really need it.
Historically, they've cut when the stock market has crashed. Like they seem to be trying to prop the stock market up when the cuts aren't a good thing when it happens. The cuts are panic to a crash. and they don't stop the crash. Like, you can look at how many times, you can go back to 2009, you can go back to 2000, you can have a look, or 2007, and you can have a look at how many times they cut, how fast they cut, and it does nothing to the stock market, because it's the cutting impacts the real economy, and the lag is long. The lag is 18 months, 2 years, 2.5 years. It takes a long time between the cutting for that to show up in the real economy and the stock market as well. So, you know, that's one of the, I've been focused on the yield curve inversion, which is, for people who don't know, but the yield curve is the, all of the rates, all of the yields on every government issued debt, starting from the shortest dated, which is whatever it is, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, all the way out to 30-year. In the ordinary course, the 30-year yields a lot more than the 1 month, because you got to have your money out, and there's a lot of risk having your money out for a long time. There's interest rate risk, there's inflation risk, there's some insolvency risk, there's, you know, anything can happen over 30 years. 1 month, there's less, fewer things that can happen. So when the front end of the curve, the short stuff, 1, 2, 3, 2 year, is yielding more than the 10-year or the back end of the curve, then that indicates that there's some short-term fear or something in the market, or it's the Fed pulling up rates because they're trying to cool the stock market down, cool the market down, which is where we are now. We've been inverted. The inversion started in October 2022. The median inversion is 12 months, and then there's some sort of hiccup in the stock market that causes the Fed to lower rates. But this is the longest inversion that we've ever had. And at one point, it was the steepest inversion that we've ever had. There's no sort of correlation between the steepness of the curve and, you know, the depth of the recession that follows, which there's like 8 for 8. There's not very many instances, but 8 for 8 instances where there's a recession following the yield curve inversion. So this is the longest inversion, but there is a correlation between the length of the inversion and the length of the recession. And I think that's because there's such a long lag between the interest rates going up and the effects knocking through to the real economy. So we've got the longest inversion on record, and at one point it was the steepest inversion on record. So I don't know what happens subsequently, but the event that most closely precipitates the recession is often the normalization or the uninversion of the curve, which is the Fed dropping the rates because it's seen the stock market crashing, or it's seen banks failing, or whatever the case may be. And I thought that that was where we were when SVB and those other banks got into trouble about this time last year. I thought, well, this is what happened when you invert. This is exactly what you would expect to see. But somehow they opened that BTFP, whatever it was, the bank facility that banks could access rather than going through the ordinary window, which they had to report. They could go use this thing and they didn't have to let anybody know that they were using it. And that soaked up like $1 trillion. They sucked out $1 trillion of that stuff, and there was no kind of broader impact on the economy. So I think that all of the old rules have really been thrown out. I kind of follow it closely. I try to understand what's happening, but I don't really use it to predict anything. I think the setting that you got to have in the stock market is the market can go down 50% at any given point in time. When it goes down 50%, your forward returns have doubled, and that's a great time to be fully invested rather than like trying to pull your money out, which is what everybody's trying to do at that point. So that's, it's unpredictable. What will happen will happen. It will go down 50% at some time in the future. When it happens, you want to be fully invested at that time. You probably should be fully invested now. You can't predict it. So that's kind of, I just ignore all the macro and all of the economy stuff and just try and buy cheap stocks that have got a lot of yield and a sensible management team that's buying back stock and will buy back more when it goes down. And that's how you become a little bit anti-fragile. When the stock goes down, management team buys back more. You're getting richer faster, even though it doesn't feel like it. And ultimately, if you survive and you get through to the other side, it all works out.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, the macro is probably something that investors are like the most interested in paying attention to, but it's probably like the least useful in terms of actually running an investment strategy. Like with our podcast, like the YouTube algorithm loves the macro. Like whenever we put the macro guys up, it's like the views are way up and we're all happy over here. And like, but it's not, you know, and I think it's very interesting. Like I like understanding what's going on behind the scenes and what triggers inflation and of past inflation cycles. And I think all that's very interesting. I just don't know what to do with it in terms of building an investment strategy.
Yeah, 100%. That's where I am too. I think it's really interesting. I think it's really fun to follow. I think it gets a lot of clicks and a lot of views. And I have a podcast too. So I don't talk about it for that reason. I talk about it because I can't really talk about the funds that I run. I don't really like to talk about individual positions because every single position that I put on, you know, there's some dispute about whether there's a reason why the stocks are down. You know, they're down because people don't like them. And I think that there's a chance that people have overreacted or the market's overreacted, which is why the price is down relative. So, you know, Facebook Meta was a good example of that. When it was down, it was friendless. And I used to talk about it a little bit on the podcast because I talk about one or two stocks occasionally. And I'd get all of these things, all of these people pointing out all of the business problems with it. You know, Reels is getting eaten by TikTok and so on and so on. Zuck's locked us, sealed us into this. We're in this death, you know, thing with Zuck where he's going into the metaverse and nobody really knows what that is. And they're spending $12 billion a year in metaverse stuff. And I can see that stuff too. And it worried me too, but it was also half price, you know, and it was a pretty good business throwing off a lot of cash. If I'd listened to all those people and got scared out of it, then you miss the run on the other side when it recovers too. And then once it goes back to where it was and the opportunity's gone, then everybody's like, oh, I knew that was going to happen. It was too cheap. Everybody's driving in the rearview mirror. So I just like to buy these things as cheaply as I possibly can and then try not to talk about them too much. And then if you can't talk about the stocks that you own, which is really the only thing that I do, all that's left is macro and the economy, yeah, which gets really good views on Twitter and YouTube. So you're kind of encouraged to talk about it, even though that's not the right way to run an investment strategy.
Just so you know, though, since we're all about the views over here, like the title of this is going to be something like Tobias Carlyle predicts global collapse after yield curve inversion. With like some fire burning next to you probably and like a big chart going down to the right. I think that's probably what we'll go with on YouTube.
I've also said something like the market will be down 50%. Like that's my evergreen setting. The market, it's not a prediction. That's just an observation. And you can once the market's gone down 50%, like wait a year and run it again. And it'll be me saying the market's going to go down 50%, which will also be true. The market will go down 50% multiple times. It's going to go down 50% 5 or 10 times before I'm finished, I think. So I agree with you 100%. But run it, do it.
We'll take the 50% part and we'll just cut that little part out. And we'll run that as a clip too. That's just you saying over and over again, the market's going to go down 50%.
I think if it works, I'll be pointing back to it saying, hey, I predicted it.
Speaking of like macro and markets, you know, this year's kind of turning out to be, and I wasn't quite sure at the end of last year. I mean, it was a good year for large cap growth coming off of a good year for value, let's say in 2022, you know, when you're looking at value and growth and what outperformed or underperformed.
Didn't go down as much.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like, you know, okay. I mean, you could look at the numbers. I mean, yes, value did better, but it still wasn't like, it wasn't like it was positive and growth was like down 15%, you know, it was still down. But, you know, this year's turning out to be interesting. It's like, it's kind of like back, it's sort of like a continuation, I guess, of what we saw at the beginning of last year, which is very narrow leadership. I mean, small cap value for the most part is flat for the year. The S&P is going to end the quarter probably up 10%. And it's like, what is the catalyst? Like, does it just... You know, you hear people that small caps and mid caps, there's a catch up trade, but then for that to happen, you know, I think you have to have higher growth. I mean, maybe the Fed, maybe rate cuts would be enough of a catalyst to get some momentum in that area. I don't know. It's just an interesting market when you have the small and mid caps just flat and, you know, large caps by the S&P 500 up 10%. I don't even know what the NASDAQ 100 is. I haven't looked at the NASDAQ this year, but I'm sure it's more.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's been such a bad, you know, there's this gentleman, Mikhail Samanov, he's written this 200 years of value where he's gone and stitched together three data sets. And it's the one we all use, the French data, which starts in about 1926. And then there's the Cowles Commission data, which is what Benjamin Graham used to say that he thought that value would do about 15% a year. And that was like 1875 to 1925, something like that. And then somebody has gone and done this deep dive where they look at old, you know, to the extent that you could get any published information about anything from like 1825 to 1875. And they were looking at dividend yields to determine value. And then he stitched those all together. And you can see all these crashes of the relative performance of growth and value over 200 years. So value is having its worst drawdown through to 2020, I think. And typically where value has had these worst drawdown and worst relative performance in like 200 years of beta, which is something. And then he said, you know, and typically when that's happened, you get this catch-up period afterwards, and the catch-up just hasn't happened. It's done a little bit better at times, and it's certainly not losing ground anymore on a consistent basis, although that it is sort of running up and then running back down. And we've been running backwards probably since the start of the year or something like that, I would say. So the value guys are suffering, I would say. That's probably why there's not very many value guys in small cap value. It's just too hard to kind of live there. I think the market certainly feels like the frothiest parts of the kind of pre, you know, when everybody was locked in and everybody was day trading. We're not kind of at that level of froth, but we are at like Bitcoin all-time highs. Nvidia has had this monster run, and it's a little bit self-reflective because they sell the chips back into that AI. And, you know, everybody in like the, all of the other companies that are big are buying their chips from Nvidia. So there's a lot of, I think there's a little bit of double counting going on there too, because you don't expense the chips when you buy them. You buy them and Nvidia gets to count that as revenue, but all of the other companies depreciate those over a series of years. So they're not, there's no equivalent like cost on the other side. The cost is distributed over a few years. So it looks like we're having this renaissance of like lots of earnings being made. I'm not entirely sure that that's happening, but I don't know. I'm just sort of speculating about that. So there's a lot of froth on top, and then there's all of these other businesses on the bottom. If you look at, so Ed Yardini publishes these great charts on his site. They're all free. I go and check them out every now and again. You can look at any number of different things, but one of the interesting things that he puts up is large cap, mid cap, small cap PEs tracked back about 20 something years. And you can see that for most of the last 20 years, the PEs on mid cap and small cap have been at a premium to the PEs of large cap companies. And in the pandemic 2020 drop, it reversed. And now the large cap PEs are higher than mid and small cap PEs. And I don't know if that's, I just don't know why one thing should be one way and the other thing should be the other way. I don't know that there's any like mean reversion. I don't know if one thing should go back to being, I don't know that mid and small should be at a premium to big or the other way around. I don't think that one of them is right and the other one's wrong. It's just interesting that it's flipped over, and it could easily flip the other way again at some point in time, given that there's no real reason for it to be one way or the other. So I would much rather make a bet on small and mid here, even though I think those PEs are reasonably stretched relative to their long run averages, even though it doesn't feel great in small and mid cap land. We're getting paid pretty well for the earnings that we're getting in there. We're getting pretty good multiples in there. It's just that large is getting such massive multiples that it sort of dwarfs everything else underneath it. This is a bloody hard market to navigate, is all I would say.
Yeah, it's been challenging.
Interested in your thoughts on this, and hopefully I'm not putting you in a weird spot here, but did you happen to see that Bloomberg piece highlighting the changes in the Fama French data, the adjustments?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm just wondering, as someone, I mean, you've done a lot of testing with the acquirers multiple and your other strategies that you've run. So you have, you know, you kind of get the quant testing thing. And I just find it, you know, let me just read you this. So they do make adjustments. And so one of the things that the article pointed out is that that data isn't actually coming from like Fama French and like the CRISP database is actually coming from Dimensional. Is where those returns are being generated. And there was an academic paper that kind of looked at this difference. So they looked at like two different vintages. They looked at like the returns from 1926 to 2005. And then they looked at the same period. So 1926 to 2005, they looked at like the value factor return of that period And then in 2022, they pulled that same vintage. So they pulled 1926 to 2005. And what they found was a 4 basis point monthly difference between the two vintages. Now that seems like maybe not a lot, but the difference was pretty big. So a $10,000 investment in 1926 in the first vintage would have resulted in about $250,000 ending portfolio balance. Whereas in the second vintage, it would have resulted in approximately a $400,000 portfolio value. So that's a big end number. And I'm just wondering, like, how does that strike you? Given someone that's done testing, you've done back testing, obviously you've looked at the Fama French data. Like, to me, I was kind of like really taken back by that, because I was like, whoa, this is like crazy that like these adjustments, you know. And again, on the surface, it doesn't seem like it would result in a big end number, but when compounded over a very long period of time, like 4 basis points is a lot at the end of the day. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think the concern is that they've gone and backdated. They've gone backwards in time and changed the data. And I wasn't aware that that was going on. I don't know if other people were aware that that was going on, or the disclosure was sort of not
right
comprehensible. Like, nobody really understood that that was the case. And somebody had to write an academic paper showing the extent of the change. And it seemed a little bit scandalous, like they were, oh, we're changing the data now. Like, we all thought this was fixed. We thought these were the actual returns. And now we find out that the returns weren't the returns. And you know, what's to say that we're not going to go back and revise it again and get a completely different answer again? And then they have responded to it with their own kind of academic paper, explaining why they have done what they have done. I'm sort of a little, I didn't dig right into it, but I saw Cliff Asness responded to it, and Cliff said, you know, these guys are competitors of mine. So I'm in no way, shape or form, you know, there's no advantage to me to cover for these guys, but he seemed he thought it was benign, and he thought they've just improved the data. They haven't changed it. So I was sort of satisfied with Cliff's response to it, because Cliff is much, much closer and better at this stuff and has much more resources at his disposal than I do. So it's sort of, I thought that was okay. But having said that, I've done a lot of testing, and I have seen so many different results from all of the testing that I have done. It's so, you know, it's like that, you know, you use the telescope to look into the night sky, and you bump the telescope by a fraction of an inch and it changes the galaxy.
You'll never see it again.
Right. So I've done so much testing now that I really don't, if someone comes along to me and says, oh, I've got this strategy that outperforms, but I just, you know, maybe. I've tested so much that I just basically don't trust any of the testing anyway. I just sort of ask, is this logical? That does buying cheap cash flows work over time? I think that it does. Does overpaying for cash flows reduce your returns? Like, logically, yes, it should. Like, the actual, down to the, you know, number of positions after the dot, I don't know. So I it's a little bit frustrating that that's happened, and I've published plenty of stuff using that data, so I'll probably have to go back and revise it and see if it still works.
Revising your revisions.
What do you think? Like, you guys do a lot of testing too. Like, you use your own data.
I don't know. You know, to me, like, I just know we run models on Validia. We've been running them for 20 years. They're not academic based, but we never go back and make adjustments, or, and, you know, we're running portfolios, and those portfolios are being tracked in a real live way. So I sort of feel like once the data is live, once it's out there live in the public domain and people are making decisions on it or building investment products on it, it just seems a little off that, like, the adjustments. And to your point about the disclosures, like, maybe it was disclosed somewhere in the fine print or behind the, I even saw someone, which this is crazy to me, when I read the Bloomberg piece, it was like, data provided by Dimensional Fund Advisors was on the site. And so then I've been on the Fama French, I've been on the Ken French site a lot. And so I'm like, I've never seen it. I'm like, where is that?
I don't know that either. You had to
click the source code to find the disclosure. So it's kind of like, geez, what's going on? But I think your response is excellent, actually. And it kind of reminds me too. I remember Barron's tried to replicate Greenblatt stuff. They couldn't come anywhere close to that. And it was like, what data set are you using?
What market cap cutoffs are you using?
Yeah.
What month of the year are you rebalancing?
Right.
In quantitative value, when we wrote quantitative value, we rebalanced in June, but we used the year-end data to give 6 months for all of that, because they go back and revise. You know, many, many financial statements are revised after the fact too. And so you got to find some way to deal with a look-ahead bias. There's no foolproof way of doing it. You just sort of, the way I think about it, you're just trying to get you're looking through a very, very dirty lens, trying to get some idea about what's going on. So you got to be careful about, you don't have a great deal of precision. If you find something that outperforms by 4 basis points over a very long period of time, like that could be trading costs. There's any number of reasons why that's not implementable in the real world. So I think that, you know, in some ways, Greenblatt's approach was the right one. He just sort of said, this is the way that I think that Buffett invests. Buffett looks at this quality metric and he looks at this value metric and he combines them together. And I'm going to go and do that. And then I'm going to test that and it works. And then we replicated that in quantitative value. We didn't get the same results. We got different results. But when were we rebalancing? But we got different results in the sense that we got different yearly returns, but we got the same theme. It was true that what he was finding was outperforming and it was probably beating the market. And I think that it's funny that it hasn't really worked in live implementation since, but that could just be because value hasn't really worked for the last 20 years or something like that.
It's interesting. While you were giving that response, I was actually, before you mentioned Cliff, I was pulling up Cliff's thing on Twitter, and you know, I can't read all of Cliff's thing on Twitter because it's a bit aggressive, but he did say, value back tests have indeed gotten better over time as data has been improving. Not to make value better, that suggestion is obscenely uncalled for. It's exactly what you'd expect if value is real and there were data errors, as data errors are noise and make a strategy worse. So Cliff has been like vehemently defending this stuff. And, Cliff is where I go for, Cliff is, to me is like the person I probably look up to the most in this area. So I figure if he's standing behind this, it's probably, it's probably not as big an issue as they were making it out to be. And the other thing I would say too is, and I think it's really important for anybody, any investor, and I make a lot of these. So I think it's really important for me as well, is you always have to be incredibly skeptical of backtests. To your point before, where you're talking about what companies are you including? Are there micro caps in there? How is the data? Is the data clean? Are you data mining to just get the result you want? Whenever anyone presents anyone with a back test, I think you have to be incredibly skeptical of what you're seeing, because there's just so many things that go into that and so many things that could be wrong with that. And also, history doesn't always, repeat itself. The past doesn't always predict the future. So to me, that's a big lesson from all of this, is just be very, very skeptical of any historical results you see, and just make sure you understand what you're seeing.
I mean, there's a broader theme than just, it's not even just in finance. It's sort of more broadly that there's this replication crisis where they find something's got a p-value that says that it's significant in the cohort that they're looking for. But there's a lot of motivated reasoning too. People want their studies to succeed, and they go back and they revisit them later and they can't find the same effect. And so it's no surprise to me that it's trivial to backtest any number of things. And that's what AI is basically doing. It's just a curve fitted to a data set. It's not quite a linear regression. It's a little bit more sophisticated than that, but it's pretty close. And then if you haze the data for long enough, you just test every single thing you can find, you're going to find those spurious correlations. I think in quantitative value, we talked about spurious correlations, and there's this website that you can go to where they just take two completely unrelated data sets. And it's like Bangladeshi butter production and GDP in the US. And they find that there's a statistically significant correlation between the two, and there's clearly no connection between the two. And it'd be like the success of Nick Cage movies and drownings in backyard pools. Like all of these things are connected statistically, but clearly not connected in the real world. If you test one data set and you're looking for statistically significant connections, you'll find one. And even if you say, I'm going to break it into two parts, I'm going to test one part, then you're going to get some things that will survive that first test. And then I'm going to test in the second half of the data. Some of those will survive the second half of the data, even though they don't work at all. And then you've got all of the other little implementation errors. I mean, are you trading at the bid? Are you trading at the ask? Are you trading in between? Is there enough liquidity to absorb your strategy? You know, the small cap, you know, the small minus large was like, everybody kind of knew that small caps outperformed large caps. And that sort of seems to have gone away. Price to book seemed to massively outperform. Cheap price to book outperformed expensive price to book. That's kind of gone away a little bit. You know, these things aren't immutable, even though both of those things kind of make sense to me. Like small caps, maybe they are riskier, so therefore maybe they should earn more in terms of returns. Cheap price to book, maybe that's value. You should earn a little bit more than expensive on a price to book basis. But you could make a pretty coherent argument the other way too. Big caps are better, higher quality, so therefore they tend to outperform. Expensive stuff has got better cash flows and therefore it tends to outperform, something like that. I don't know, but it's, you have to be, as you say, extremely skeptical when you look at these things. And I think even if you do all of that, you're still going to find stuff that's not real.
You've never seen a bad back test.
That's right. You've never seen a bad back test because all the bad ones get strangled in the crib. Only the ones that look good make it out into the wide world.
Just shake out the AI thing a little bit, because we've had Doug, and I kind of agree with you. I kind of think if you're using AI to build investment strategies or let's say build portfolios, you're effectively by default, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that like it's effectively using historical data to construct what it thinks is an optimized portfolio. Doug Clinton from Deepwater, who's a great guy and super smart guy. We just had him on the podcast. We talked about technology, boom and bust bubbles and stuff. But one of the side projects he has going on is since June of last year, he kind of uses a consensus AI engine system. So he uses OpenAI, Claude, and then Gemini, I think, if I'm getting those three right, to construct. And he has all like maybe, I don't know, there might be like 30 different indices that he's running. And however he's defined those strategies, and he's been tracking the performance in real time. And obviously it's, that's going to be ultimately at the end of the day, he's not using it to, like, he's built portfolios and he's starting on whatever, June 1st of 2023 was starting with, you know, real time performance tracking. So 5 years from now or 10 years from now, or whatever the date is that investors can look at this thing, maybe you need a full market cycle or two different market regimes. I don't know, but like he's tracking the effectiveness versus like market cap weighted indices, which is interesting.
AI or machine learning or whatever you want to call it, however they implement it, the idea is basically the same. They've got some dependent variable, some independent variable. They're looking at how the change in one impacts the change in the other in every single update. And so it just fits a curve and it'll say, when this thing moves this way, when this variable moves like this, we anticipate that this variable will move like that. So the computer makes a prediction and it gets its next layer of data and it says it didn't move that way. We need to make a little adjustment and it keeps on adjusting. And for many, many things, it does seem to be a pretty good way of, that's a good way of predicting what will happen, because there's a lot of things that the relationship is stable over time. The problem with investing, I think, a little bit is that the relationship doesn't seem to be stable. It seems to change all the time. There's this law of ever-changing cycles in horse racing, betting, and also in investing, where when something gets successful and popular, everybody seems to pile into it and that seems to stop it from working. So the accruals is an excellent example of that. This paper came out showing that accrual, when you had big accruals, it meant that there was an accounting profit being made that wasn't matched by an equivalent cash flow. And so when the two get very wide, it means maybe you've got an Enron where they're just pretending that they're making these profits because they're writing up assets, but the cash flows aren't there. So it's not a real profit. It's purely an accounting profit. And that has to be, you have to capture that in double book double entry bookkeeping. It's captured somewhere. It's captured in the balance sheet as an accrual. So growing accruals or a big accrual is a little bit of a red flag for auditors and for analysts. I wrote this paper and it had been an incredibly robust way of finding frauds or finding companies that were going to underperform that had these accruals. And of course, once they published it, everybody started using it and the effect went away for a little period of time or for a long time. But then somebody wrote the story up saying, hey, this accruals thing used to work and now it doesn't work anymore because it got so popular. And then it sort of got abandoned a little bit and it's back to working again because people sort of stopped paying attention to it. But it's a good idea. Like the theory of it is sound. The implementation of it is difficult because it's competitive and we're all using the same signals. And it is, that's the criticism of value, that such a simple thing, so easy to go and calculate a price to fundamental ratio for anything. Why would that continue to work? And the answer is in the implementation, when you actually look at the portfolio of stuff that you're going to buy with these, you know, you look like a lunatic when you put in some of these portfolios because they're filled with stuff that's obviously going to go to zero. There's obvious problems with all of these companies, which is kind of what keeps value evergreen. Having said that, value does cycle. Clearly value cycles. We've been through a big down cycle. We're debating whether it cycles back up the other side, even though I think that it does. I think it is an evergreen cycle. I think it is an evergreen idea. And I do think it's a good idea to buy cheap cash flows and kind of, if you don't know what the future holds, would you rather be getting more per dollar of earnings? Would you pay more per dollar earnings or less per dollar earnings? Of course, you want to pay less if you have no idea. It's the sort of the, you know, the Occam's razor is you prefer the theory that assumes the least. And I think that paying less for your cash flows assumes the least. And so I think it's the most sort of, I don't want to use the word humble, but intellectually humble and like modest in terms of what it assumes. So I think that value should work, but we've gone through a very long cycle where it hasn't. So that's by no means like guaranteed.
Yeah. Speaking of Occam's razor, is that the method you're taking with the book? Simpler is better?
I just think that's a good approach to life, basically. It just makes it easier to kind of understand when something blows up, why it blew up, why something works. Yeah, I think Occam's razor is always slightly misquoted as the simpler the better, but really it's prefer the theory that assumes the least. And I think that's a pretty good approach.
That's interesting. Yeah, I learned something new for sure.
I hope I've quoted that correctly.
Justin, Jack, do you have anything else before I ask sort of this last?
No, that's fine. You can go.
Okay. So sort of ending question here. What worries you the most, but what also gives you the most amount of optimism? You can go in anywhere you want with it.
I think that there's this kind of creeping authoritarianism around the world. And I don't think that authoritarianism is good. And I think that the tools that we have to surveil and control people now are just vastly greater than anything we've ever seen in the past. Like you can imagine the Soviet Union with these awesome powers of surveillance, or China kind of as an example of a country with awesome powers of surveillance implementing them. And I think that there's this kind of hunger for it in the young people in the US, but a lot of the Western world. And I think that a lot of the world, though a lot of the Western world is a long way down this path, like Canada and Australia are, as an Australian American, but Australian originally, born and raised, there's a lot more of it in Australia. It's much easier to implement in Australia. The thing that gives me the most optimism is that there is this, I think there is a pushback in the US, and I think that the US was really one of the few countries in the world that pushed back hardest against a lot of the COVID restrictions and a lot of that silliness. And that kind of gives me some optimism that I do think the pendulum is swinging back a little bit. I think it's a shame that we've had hundreds of years of this liberal Western democracy, these ideas of free speech, and we've kind of forgotten the reason why everybody fought so hard and so long for all of those things, you know, knocking off despotic kings and tyrants and, you know, regimes that kind of wanted to subjugate their people. And here we are in the West with all of these, our ancestors fought hard for all of these freedoms, and we're trying to willingly give them up. I think that's a shame. I think that's a risk, but I do think that the pendulum's swinging back the other way. And I think that America is place that is pushing back harder. So that's the thing that gives me the greatest deal of optimism.
Awesome.
Thank that you, was Toby. Not an investment thing.
That's all right, man. Love it. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys. Always a pleasure. I love chatting to you guys.
Thank you.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarbonell. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.